Hello and welcome to the Pod of the Damned. I'm your host Ian, and as you may have seen if you're watching this in the video episode, we are joined by not Nico today. Nico's off today. He's unfortunately a little bit under the weather. He would have been joining us otherwise, but we are joined by a previous guest from the show, a regular contributor to the Horror Flicks and Guitar Picks podcast as well. Please welcome back Ren to the show. Welcome back, Ren. How are you doing today?
I am doing great. I'm happy to be here. Yeah, I'm looking forward to talking about a film that I feel a little bit better about than Terrifier.
Yes. When you joined us last time, it was to talk about Terrifier. And you weren't particularly high on that movie. You refused flat out to return to the show to discuss Terrifier 2.
If it makes you feel any better, I think I've flat out refused to come back on my own on the Horror Flicks and Guitar Picks to do Terrifier 3. So
okay, so I won't bother asking you to come onto this show for Terrifier 3 then. That's just straight flat out of the water. But no, welcome back to the show. It's a pleasure to have you here. Thank you for coming on.
Of course.
We are obviously a horror podcast that deep dives into a different topic every single week in our quest to create a leaderboard of the best and worst horror movies of all time. This is episode number 102, and in today's show we're talking about The Black Phone. I'm hoping this is going to be quite an interesting discussion because, you know, I'd kind of missed this a little bit when it first came out. And then it was only in the last couple of months that I finally sort of got round to checking it out. I'm sure it's probably the same for you, Ren, and for all of our, you know, sort of friends in podcasting, that sometimes, you know, with the best will in the world, you just don't have the time to fit in all the horror movies that you actually want to fit in. So this is one that kind of fell through the cracks a little bit for me. So I'm really glad we managed to sort of swing back and capture it, because I've personally heard nothing but good things about this movie. You know, in the build-up to it, obviously I've seen a few opinions from our listeners, which we'll get into later on, but in the build-up to it, it was one of the ones that had kind of gone in with relatively high expectations, and that to me is not always a good thing. That tends to mean that I usually will come away at least a little bit disappointed. So it was certainly an interesting watch for me. What about you? Did you sort of capture this when it first came out, or was this one that sort of slipped for you as well?
No, I saw this, I don't know if it was opening night, but it was definitely opening weekend that it came out. I always tell people, I'm like, I'm a card-carrying member of the Church of Stephen King. So naturally, like, I like a lot of his son, like I gave his son a chance, and I like a lot of Joe Hill's stuff. I wasn't too familiar with the story because it's a short, but I like felt like I needed to go see this like opening weekend. I also, it's funny you mentioned like the high expectations. When there's a movie that like piques my interest in either like a negative way or a positive way, I try to like see it as fast as possible, because I don't want to have either low or high expectations. I want to like get it, because as soon as people start talking about it and it gets hyped up, I'm almost always a smidge disappointed. There's movies here and there that sneak through that have gotten high praise and I'm like, okay, that was awesome. But most of the time I it fails to hit the expectations that I personally set on things.
Yeah, no, I'm in the exact same boat as you. So sometimes when it does come the case that, you know, something does slip through the net, or I just can't find the time to, you know, go see something that's brand new out, it actually almost puts me off going to watch it further down the line. It's kind of happened to me a little bit with Pearl. Like, so obviously I checked out X, but I never really got around to checking out Pearl. And obviously with the huge amount of hype that's gone around with those two movies, like, it's almost kind of put me off. I've still not checked out Pearl, just because, probably purely down to the fact that everyone's been hyping it up so much. And I wasn't as high on X anyway as like a lot of other people were. So, you know, those things combined for me just like, it's really put me off going to see that. So I'm with you completely. Like, if it's best to try and see things as soon as possible.
Yeah, if not, I wait until like a really, really long time. And people are like, you're just seeing that now. I'm like, yeah, I wasn't going to see it when, because it usually my expectations, either low or high, will get curbed. Yeah. Like before if I let it stretch out for a while, I don't want to go too far. Like, and I would say for, you know, not to get too much on X and Pearl, I would definitely say see Pearl soon because Maxine's coming.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, definitely. It's definitely one. I keep saying it to Nico. You know, I'll get around. He goes, you haven't watched it yet, and I'm like, no, I've still not watched it. But I will come around and see it eventually. But anyways, we're not here to talk about X and Pearl. We're here to talk about The Black Phone. Yep. Before we get into the discussion, Ren, would you like to just sort of tell everyone where you can be found on your social medias if anyone wants to check out any of the shows or the things that you work on? Do you want to give a brief, a quick?
Yeah, I'm. Yeah, I'm pretty much on all the socials under the handle RenXXX. And you can catch me monthly on the Horror Flicks and Guitar Picks podcast, which is Horror Flicks and Guitar Picks Pod on Instagram. And then it's Horror Flicks and Guitar Picks podcast on like everything else. What that show is, though, is Tim Mills. He hosts musicians, sometimes some people from the film industry. Gets their relationship with horror, how it started, how it's evolved, you know, what types do they like, dislike, do they have any actual like horror stories or ghost stories in their personal lives? And a lot of, you know, there's beats that he wants to hit on, but a lot of those, the best episodes are the ones where they the conversation kind of goes off into its own direction. So yeah, that's where you can find me. And I would suggest listen to some of Tim's interviews because there's some doozies in there. I think they're that are definitely worth checking out.
And obviously, Tim Mills has previously been on the show as well. For anyone who wants to go and check that out, he was on our Bucket List Horror Side series, which you know, we managed to get sort of 5 or 6 episodes of that out. And I'm still looking to keep it going. I know Ren, we've kind of got one on the back burner for that as well. But he came on to talk about Audition being one of his sort of bucket list of horror movies. So please go check that out. I've obviously appeared on the Horror Flicks and Guitar Picks podcast once myself as well, on a sort of general a horror trivia quiz episodes, which I'm, you know, I won't give away spoilers for anyone who's not listened to, but you know, I did win. So, if you would like to support this podcast on social media, you can do so. We're on X at Damn Podcast. We're on Facebook and Instagram, Pod of the Damned. You can email us at podofthedamned@gmail.com, and you can subscribe to our Patreon, patreon.com/ Pod of the Damned. You can subscribe to us there for just £1. You get early access to all of our video recordings episodes. We've got a new side series that's going to be dropping there very, very soon in the next few days, with me and Nico going to be doing non-horror movie reviews, and hopefully a couple other little bits and pieces that are going to come over the next month as well. With that being said, I think we should probably get into just talking about this movie.
I'm all for it.
Awesome. Right, so today we are talking about The Black Phone.
I'll be home in the morning.
Where are you going?
I'm staying over at Susie's tonight.
What's new? The flyer.
The papers call him the grabber.
I wish you wouldn't call him that.
You don't actually believe that story, do you? Because he can't hear you, and he doesn't really take kids that safe.
You goof. Well, isn't that just peachy keen?
You need some help?
You see that? Yeah. Would you hand me my hat? Yes, sir. I am a part-time magician.
Are those black balloons in there?
Would you like to see a magic trick?
I have an announcement to make. One of our students, Finney Blake, was abducted.
What if I could help the police find Finny?
Does it work? Not since I was a kid.
I'll scream. I'll scratch your face.
This face?
Daddy, I had a dream about it.
What happened in your dream?
He was taken.
By a man with black balloons?
Yes.
We never released those details.
Hello?
Don't hang up.
Who are you?
You know all our names? Let the dreams be real.
See the wall in front of you? I tore a long cable loose from down there.
There's a combination lock on the inside of the storm door.
What's the combination?
I carved it in the wall.
Hang up the phone!
The tree, the door, the gate. I'd never seen it before except in my dreams.
You don't have much time. You're gonna use a weapon. You raise the phone, step back, and swing.
Look what you made me do.
Please hurry!
You remember what I told you?
There's someday I have to stand up for myself.
Someday is today, Finn.
This movie was first released in 2021, was directed by Scott Derrickson, and stars Ethan Hawke, Mason Thames, and Madeline McGraw. The IMDb plot is as follows. After being abducted by a child killer and locked in a soundproof basement, a 13-year-old boy starts receiving calls on a disconnected phone from the killer's previous victims. Now, obviously, I said to you there, you know, that this was a movie that sort of had slipped me by a little bit when it first came in, and I managed to sort of come around relatively quickly. But it certainly, and obviously I'd heard like positive things about it. I'd heard really good things about, you know, Ethan Hawke's performance. I'd heard really good things about Mason Thames' performance. When we did our end of year awards last year, I think Ethan Hawke like took home Best Supporting Actor award for that. So, you know, I'd obviously heard really good things about it, and I'd heard little bits and pieces. I obviously try and keep myself as spoiler free as possible, but even then, I was still sort of pleasantly surprised, because this is a sort of supernatural thriller type movie that, rather than, you know, I've seen a lot of people say, oh, that, you know, this isn't really like an out and out horror movie, and to an extent, I maybe kind of agree with them to that, but I was kind of pleasantly surprised by that a little bit. I was really happy with the fact that this was so, it was so much more tense than I thought it was going to be. I don't know if that's something that you maybe feel like. The tension for me in this movie just sort of is there from the word go, and it never really lets up all the way through.
No, it really doesn't. And that's one thing, we can credit Scott Derrickson for his directing, but like, I think that you're correct in that, is that it, yeah, once he, I mean, he showed the grabber or whatever they call him, he shows up kind of quickly, and kids start disappearing like right from the jump. And then obviously, like, you know, once we get into like the meat of the story, where he catches Finney, he, you know, then it's, you know, it's all tension. And that's when the supernatural stuff starts to get. And I thought there was some legitimately like, There's definitely a few. The first time I watched it, I was like, you know, you almost get like nervous for the characters, because I was like, how is this going to like play out for them? And, you know, some things that we'll get into in a little bit that I didn't see coming, like I didn't anticipate them, certain plot devices that they used to happen that I thought really helped, like, you know, drive home that tension a lot more.
Yeah, definitely. And I think for me, there's always this sort of tension as well when you've got a movie that's sort of centered around kids being kidnapped, and there is that sort of vulnerability that comes with, you know, the fact that your sort of main victims of the movie are children, you know, and these are like actual children. You know, we go back to things like one of the most famous horror villains of all time is a child murderer in Freddy Krueger, but, you know, it's handled in such a different fashion in comparison to, say, how the grabber is handled here. And for me, obviously, I'm pretty familiar with both Scott Derrickson and obviously co-written by C. Robert Cargill as well, yeah, who have worked together on a number of projects. I've worked with Ethan Hawke as well and Sinister. And, you know, their projects have had varying levels of success. You know, I think, yeah, the differences between Hellraiser, Inferno and Sinister in terms of how they're perceived, for example, yeah, are a bit night and day. But, you know,
I actually have a funny thing about Hellraiser Inferno. I tweeted I like included Scott Derrickson in my tweet, and I was like, I bet he learned a lot about what not to do when making that movie. And he responded with, yes, he did.
No, but I think that's always a really interesting point, isn't it? And I think something, you know, take away from the movie for just a second, is something as well, I think it goes for podcasts as well. It goes for any sort of content creator. You know, I think a lot of people sometimes maybe get a bit nervous about approaching these people who have written and directed and starred in horror movies. And, you know, if the horror movie's no good, the horror movie's no good. However, that's not to say that it's still not been a good learning process for the people involved, and they've maybe like developed ideas. And at the end of the day, some of our favorites are considered, you know, trash by the wider community. So definitely, we can sit here and we can shit on things like Hellraiser Inferno or, you know, Urban Legends Final Cut or, you know, Sinister 2. But, you know, out of that, you know, we got Sinister, which is, you know, a really highly thought of movie. We have, you know, VHS 85, which they both worked on as well. You know, Exorcism of Emily Rose. You know, everyone has their ups and downs anyway. But, you know, being familiar with their work, you know, maybe gave me a little bit of security. But there's like a going back to what I was saying, there's always that sort of line you almost don't, you don't want them to cross when it comes to child victims, regardless of, you know, how you like your horror movies, you know. And it's essentially the difference between having, you know, A Nightmare on Elm Street and a Serbian film. You know, you want there to be that line that they just don't cross. But there is, for me, always that sort of little bit of nervousness and tension about whether or not they're going to do that. And the fact that, you know, they certainly alluded, I think that was the big thing for us as well, because for me, in a lot of horror movies, you know, you want to be, you know, it's telling a story. Don't just show me a story, tell me a story and let my imagination run away with it. And they did absolutely do that in this film, because we didn't see fairly any of the abuse that these children actually suffered at the hands of the grabber. It was completely left to her own imagination. And I think that really amplified the tension as well.
No, I agree. I actually liked the idea, like you said, that line, like, some people are like, oh, I don't really care about kids being killed. And I don't really care if the kid is a victim. Like, sometimes that's necessary for a story. Yeah. But the way that you get to see the aftermaths in all these ghosts. And I don't necessarily felt that this movie had the vibe where I would have needed to see any of those kids suffer their fate. And I think, as you said, there's something about letting your imagination do the work. Because you'll always fill in the blanks better than any movie will ever do for you anyway, for your own personal taste. If you let them, you know, go out and do that, like, it's either going to be too much or too little. It's going to take away from the story. But like, if you just cycle that thought in your brain while you're watching the ghost communicate, you're like, well, I wonder how he got that mark. I wonder how that, you know, I think that was a very smart move to never show any of the victims until they were ghosts, until it was the after. Like, I think if we seen, even if they just showed one killing, I think that would have been too much.
Yeah, as well. And I think it goes to think, because, you know, you've got various points in this movie where, you know, Finn is being sort of confronted by the grabber in the basement, and he's telling Finn about, you know, about how much suffering, you know, he's made some of his previous victims go through. And even at the end, you know, when it comes Finn's time, you know, to sort of meet his maker, then he's saying, you know, he's going to make it hurt, he's going to make it last, he's going to do all these horrible, horrible things. And and again, we still don't get to see any of that again. So it continues on all the way right up until the very end, when in actual fact, the only violence you really see in this movie is when they're actually kidnapped. It's a very, very brief moment. And, you know, Finn's sort of escape, really, at the end, when he manages to get the better of the grabber. I think there's maybe one other moment in the movie when he escapes and the grabber chases him down and, you know, threatens him. But aside from that, you know, in terms of like actual violence, it's really, really minimalistic in this movie. And I think that, again, just speaks to, you know, the writing and the direction and the performances in this film, that they were able to maintain that level of tension.
I think it was also smart in the fact that we never saw it, because then we didn't know what Finn was actually walking into. So if we had seen him play out like a killing of one of the other victims, then we're like, okay, well, now we know his list, his 1, 2, 3 that like he wants to do. We don't know what that is. We're getting clues like playing naughty boy or whatever. We never actually know. And then as soon as they're like, oh, you have to play naughty boy, and everyone in the audience had the same thought. It's like, well, what the hell is naughty boy? Like, so, and I think that was good, is that we were almost playing along. We were finding out as Finn was finding out, like what's next are we in store for? Like, what's the, you know, when does this end? Like, what's this culminating towards? Like, I think that was smart too, is that to never actually show it, because we didn't have any expectations of what was coming next.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. And again, specifically when you know, when it says, you know, oh, you haven't played Naughty Boy yet, again, your brain will take you like to that really sort of dark place, and and that really sort of ramps up and creates, again, that sort of panic and tension within the viewer, you know, because we don't know what this grabber is capable of. You know, we obviously know like the limits of cinema, but, you know, we don't know like this character, what he's capable of. Obviously, you know, if anyone's read the short by Joe Hill, you know, they'll have an idea, but again, you know, things can be changed and you know, things can be adapted. So no, definitely in terms of all of that, in terms of not sort of showing us, you know, any of the violence and sort of letting us find out everything along with Finn, I thought they did a really, really great job there. is probably one of the best aspects of the movie. I do want to move on slightly to go and talk about Ethan Hawke and his performance specifically, because and we'll talk about Mason Thames as well, because you know he also for me delivers a really great performance in this movie. But I think Ethan Hawke actually does so much in this movie with so little screen time. It's really quite an incredible performance, and it's a performance from Ethan Hawke that we're really not that used to seeing. You know, he doesn't really like to play villains. He really doesn't like to play. He doesn't do a lot of horror, full stop. I know we've mentioned Sinister, which he was in previously. Obviously, he was our protagonist in that movie. Yeah. But I thought he was incredible in this film, and the performance he gave throughout was really, really strong.
I think there's two key scenes that really solidify his performance for me. So, like, throughout the whole movie, he's kind of, like, the voice that he uses is, like, this higher-pitched, like, almost clown-like delivery. But there's two scenes that really like drive me home, like how crazy he is. So when after the escape and he brings Finn back downstairs and his brother's upstairs and he's like, what was that? And he's like, he immediately turns it off and goes like to a normal person. He's like, nothing. It was Samson yelling at something. And you're like, holy shit. Like he turned it off for a second. And then the second one is at the end in the climax when the mask gets knocked off and he immediately panics. He's like he lost the, you know, his like protection or something like that. Like he needs the mask to be the killer. And once the mask was knocked off and he like, that's all he worried about was getting the mask back on. Those two scenes in particular, like really drove home. Like, I'm like, okay, this is a really good villain. Like Ethan Hawke, like really crushed this villain here. Like I don't, now that I've watched it with him doing it, I don't see anyone else being able to play that role.
Yeah.
Like, I think it's like, it's his role now.
Yeah. There's a couple of things you bring up there are quite interesting. It's interesting you bring up, you know, you had that higher pitched voice like the clown in the original short. The character of the Grabber is a clown in the short, but they changed it to, for this movie, to be a magician for sort of creative purposes. So it's interesting that you put that together there, that, you know, because that, like I say, that's originally what that character was supposed to be. And that scene as well, where the mask was taken off, that wasn't actually a direction that was given to Ethan Hawke by Scott Derrickson. That was something that he came up with himself, was that once that mask takes off, it's almost like you've just stripped away his shield, isn't it? He's completely vulnerable at that point. You know, so it's really a great performance from him. And like you say, it sort of solidifies him as a horror villain, because you know, one thing when we're talking about horror movies and we're talking about villains is, you know, they have to be memorable, and they have to be sort of not just memorable for their appearance, which, you know, I think a lot of horror movies tend to rely on, is, you know, maybe appearance over substance. But, you know, there's so much depth in that character that we actually don't get to see any of. You know, obviously you're talking about he lives with Max, his brother, played by James Ranson, who, you know, I was quite happy to see on screen. He's always someone that, you know, brings me a little bit of joy. I still call him Deputy So-and-so whenever he pops up in anything else. But you know, that there was that little twist there with that, and like you say, he was able to turn that off in that scene. We see that depth. You know, we get this whole sort of, we know he's struggling, we know he has some sort of, whether it's mental illness, whether it's, you know, foresight, whether, you know, there is something special about him. And we still don't really get to delve too deeply into that. So, you know, that and his performance, Ethan Hawke's performance, sorry, has left me wanting more of the character. And I think that's always a good spot to be left in from a performance.
I would love to, it's kind of like a shame the way the character ends up in this film, because clearly there's a finality to him. But like, yeah, it sucks that like there will be no more of him specifically, at least that, I know that there's like in development for another film, but I have no idea how they're going with it. But the idea of like losing him as a horror villain and not getting more of him is a bummer. But I also don't want a lot more of his like backstory. Like, I feel like the little that we have and those little bits that he gives us, like I said, where he turns it off or he loses the mask or whatever, it reminds me of like, well, your guy, Michael, like Michael Myers. Like, I don't want to know anymore about him. Like, I feel like the less we know about him, the more terrifying he becomes. So like, I think little bits here and there, like little like egg, like, you know, Easter eggs and whatnot is fine. But I'm glad that we didn't get much more. We just saw these little, these quick little glimpses. Mm-hmm. And that made, I think that made him a lot more terrifying. I think if I know his whole story, it might cheapen him a little bit for me.
Oh yeah. 100%. Again, because we don't know, you know, that full backstory, we don't know what he's actually gone through. You know, we can make our own assumptions again from that. I mean, we can probably assume that he's gone through some sort of parental abuse or some sort of childhood trauma, involving either parents or guardians or, you know, some people who are maybe in a position of power or something like that. I think we can probably gather that from the information that we're given on screen, you know, and that obviously transpires because that's a huge theme in this film anyway. And, you know, we'll probably talk about that a little bit more in a little bit. But like you say, you know, we really only get these really sort of short snippets here and there about him. Now, the Black Phone 2, as you mentioned, it is in pre-production. Now, according to IMDb, Ethan Hawke is attached to the movie to reprise his role. But again, we don't know in what form or sense that be, whether that's in some sort of prequel sense, whether that's in sort of flashback scenes, whether that's, you know, he didn't really die. We don't know. Like, the plot's, I think, been kept under wraps pretty well. Finn's also due to return. Mason Thames, sorry, he's also down to return. But again, you know, IMDb is not a particularly reliable source when it comes to these things as well. So we'll probably take that information with a little bit of a pinch of salt. But it would be interesting to see if they do another movie and they go with a different killer, you know, what sort of direction they go with in that as well. Because the Grabber was the selling point for this movie. You know, that mask was on all of the posters. It was Ethan Hawke was surrounded. It was him. That was all the promotional material was centered around, you know. And really, realistically, for as great as some of the child performances are in this movie, and you know as well as I do that, you know, kids in films can be a bit shaky sometimes with their with their performances. Ethan Hawke is what everyone was talking about.
Yeah. So of course, he was definitely, while he was not the lead, he was the lead, like, so to speak.
Yeah, 100%. Okay, well, on that note then, because I also mentioned the kids and, you know, Mason Thames, and we've got Madeleine McGraw in here as our sort of two main sort of kid stars, child stars, if you want. I want to talk about sort of just the general kids' performances in this movie overall, because I think they all did a really good job. I don't think there was a really weak one here. I think Mason Thames especially, you know, he had a really difficult... Madeleine McGraw had a really difficult job, I think, in this one as well, because, you know, she's someone in this movie who actually suffers like a lot of abuse at the hands of her father, and you know, that's like you say that's a recurring theme in this movie, and it really makes this movie so much more hard-hitting. You know, we physically see you know, her father beating her with a belt repeatedly, you know, over and over again, and then combining that with the abuse that the Grabber, we were sort of led to believe that the Grabber inflicts upon the rest of these kids. It really does make this quite a dark movie.
100%. The scene in particular you just brought up about the belt is like a really uncomfortable scene to watch. Because, you know, it deals with alcoholism, there's abuse, there's obviously dealing with grief of the deceased mother, who's not in the film, they just mention her a bunch. So like I remember watching and feeling really uncomfortable, like almost squirming in my seat uncomfortable when I saw that the first time in the theaters. It's obviously a little bit like, I watched it last night. This is the first time my wife watched it, and she was like, what the hell? Like, and she, you could just tell that, like, that was a real scene. And what but I think it served its purpose. It obviously showed the bond between the two kids. So, you know, she definitely had a rough go, but she sells it really well. Like, I think in that scene where she's being abused, I think that's a believable, it's a very believable scene. Like, I think she's, you know, I don't want to, I hope I don't come off bad when I say this. She's an excellent crier. She really shows her pain in that scene. And it makes that, I think, like, the way she reacts, that she's crying, she's screaming back at him and all that, is what makes that scene as uncomfortable as it is. Mm-hmm. But I don't think it's without its merit. Like, sometimes, like, people see abusive scenes and they're like, well, what the hell was the purpose of that? Like, why did we have to go through that? And I think that there was a reason for it.
I think so as well, because, you know, obviously it's sometimes very easy, I think, when we're watching a movie or someone's making a movie that's got this kind of theme where you have this villain, this killer, you know, like the Grabber, and to kind of just forget about every other sort of aspect of people's lives. Like, it becomes, this is the sort of sole focus. And I think it's an important message to send out there that, you know, sometimes, you know, it's the people who are closest to you in your lives that can be the real villains. They're the people who can, they're the people who can inflict the most pain upon you, because they're the people who are closest to you, you know. And this, that's this part, that this is, this is their father. Like you say, they've obviously suffered the loss of their mother. You know, he's really struggling with it, as I'm sure any father would, but, you know, there's varying ways of dealing with grief, and he doesn't deal with it in the correct way. You know, he turns to alcohol, he abuses his child, he beats his children. You know, and you get that scene at the very end, you know, where they're in the ambulance and he's sort of kneeling before them, begging them for forgiveness. And I felt really conflicted in that scene because, you know, I don't really want them to give him the forgiveness, because for me, there's really no excuse to ever do that to your child. Like, listen, I'm from an era where I was brought up and, you know, I would maybe get smacked if I was misbehaving when I was young. I was never ever beaten with a belt, you know, relentlessly. And we're talking about, you know, little smacks around the side of the head, you know. And I'm sure a lot of people, most people who are, you know, of our sort of age and generation would have experienced something similar to that as well, at least once or twice growing up in their childhood. But there's a big difference, isn't there, between that and then beating your child. So I was really conflicted at the end there about whether or not I wanted them to actually forgive the father or not.
But I don't think they did, though. Like, they never really, like, drove that point home. Like, he begged for forgiveness and she leaned on Finn. They never actually said, like, we forgive. There was no, like, hugging. It was just he begged for it. And then they embraced each other. So, like, in a way, like, I see what you're saying. Like, yeah, that he shouldn't get the he shouldn't get the forgiveness. Like, that's got to be earned a lot more than just, like, oh, I'm so sorry that you got kidnapped. Like, you have to work for that forgiveness. But I don't also I'm also glad that we didn't get, like, a straight up, like, that they did forgive him. Like, it's kind of ambiguous the way that and maybe it's just the way that it's edited. Maybe they did shoot a couple more seconds and it just got cut and they did embrace. But I'm glad the way it was presented was that they didn't necessarily give it to him.
Yeah, no.
I mean, it's leaning in. Definitely leaning in the direction that they did. But, like, I'm glad that they didn't straight up show it.
Yeah, no. I think that possibly would have taken away quite a bit from the message, wouldn't it? If they had shown, you know, them actually forgiving him. I agree with you as well. I think they probably do just lean into the direction that, you know, maybe not straight away, but it's eventually they've maybe forgiven him. Obviously, we may find more of that out in the sequel. We may not. Who knows? I think I agree with you. Like, if they had actually shown, you know, them giving him a forgiveness, I think that would have really diminished the message that they were trying to drive home there. So I'm also very glad that they didn't do that as well. I think overall for me, you know, like, because this is it's a really big message. You know, we're talking about alcoholism, we're talking about, you know, child abuse, childhood trauma, and just those two things combined, you know, are something that hit home for a huge majority of the population. You know, a huge portion of people will have suffered either abuse or will have suffered some sort of trauma from either having alcoholism themselves or a family member or a parent or, you know, some sort of childhood trauma through something like that. And it goes beyond that as well. You know, we're talking about alcoholism here, but, you know, that can go to drug abuse, that can go to any other sort of addiction, that can really go to anything. And 100%. I think, excuse me, I think when you've got a movie like this that is ultimately, you know, a horror movie, it's ultimately, you know, we as horror fans, you know, we want to get, you know, a cool concept and we want to get a cool villain and things like that. But it's really important that they handle these issues tactfully. And I think, again, credit to this movie, that is something that they did. They showed us some scenes, like you said, that made us feel really uncomfortable, like, you know, Madeline McGraw's character Gwen being beaten by her father, like we've just mentioned. But I think in terms of the rest of the movie as well, they really did manage to handle those issues quite tactfully, and I think that goes to a big credit for the film as well.
Yeah, I agree.
Awesome. Okay, I'm glad we agree, because I know Nico would be here and he'd just be like, ah, fuck the father. I think, you know, when it comes to this movie as well, it also, I think, you know, it sends out a message because, you know, you look at the various victims and there's a portion of the beginning of the movie where, you know, we see the victims either being kidnapped or what they're doing in the build up to them being kidnapped. And we've got a variety of different kids here. You know, we've got one who's, you know, playing baseball. We've got a paper boy. We've got, you know, a bully. And these are all sorts of people are getting kidnapped. You've got Finn, who's just kind of this sort of quiet kid who is the subject of a bully himself, but then is also getting protected by one of the other things. And I think for me, there's a really important message in there as well that, you know, not all of that stuff, all of that background stuff, sometimes it doesn't really matter. You know, it doesn't matter whether you're whether you're popular, whether you're rich, whether you're picked on, whether you're a bully, whether you're not. You know, these issues and these troubles affect everyone.
Yeah.
And I think it's another thing this movie does really well. It's just it puts everyone on a level playing field.
Yeah, and I like that. Like I like that all the I thought it was smart making all of the victims be of varying degrees for that reason. Mm-hmm. Because then it says because if he only picked on if he only grabbed the loner and or whatnot or like the quiet kid and not the, like the star baseball player or like the you know the punk like was the town like menace or anything like that, like I think if he just grabbed the loner, like that's too easy. That happens all the time. Like, and the fact that he like especially when he gets Miguel, like Miguel's the badass. Mm-hmm. You know, and he's the one that's like saves Finn, and you figure like, well, he's the one that would probably put up the best fight, and he really didn't. Like, I think that was smart to show that everyone can be touched. And I also thought there was a line that really like stuck out to me when he was talking to the paperboy. The paperboy's like, yeah, no one knows your name. He's like, until you get something like this happens, and then everyone knows your name. You're in everyone's, you know, your house. And I think that like sent a message home too. It's like once you realize like, oh shit, they kidnapped the paperboy. Like that could be me. Like I could be riding my bike down the street. Like I think that was also smart to have that line in there to just show, you know, things can change on an instant. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was smart to have everyone be different and not just the same type of kid. You know, you look at similar stuff like Joe Hill writes like his dad. Like he nails adolescence very well, but a lot of times you look at the adolescence in Stephen King's stuff, it's a group of friends that are all basically the same thing. Like you look at the kids in It, they're all like, while they all have their own personalities, they're all still like, they're the losers. Yeah. They're the losers club. In this one, they're not the losers club. They're all varying degree. And I thought that was like a really smart idea.
Yeah, as well. I think it was really shown as well because, throughout those scenes of Finn in the basement, you know, they all, you know, give him a different piece of advice, you know, when he's talking to them down the phone, you know, I can't remember which kid is which again, but, you know, one of them, you know, gives him the advice about filling the phone full of dirt and sand, and one of them gives him a bit of advice about, you know, a piece of cord or the window. And in that sort of big finale scene where Finn finally overcomes the grabber, he uses the advice from each of the other kids as well. So I think also, as well as putting him on that level playing field, as well as sort of saying it doesn't really matter whether you're, you know, like you say, the star baseball player, it doesn't matter whether you're the loner or the loser or whatever it is, they all had something to contribute as well. And I think, again, it's a really important message, I think, especially for kids growing up. You know, everyone's different, everyone has their own personalities, like you're saying, but we all have our own things to contribute as well.
Yeah, everyone has value.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah.
You know, so, and in that sense, you know, then for me, this becomes a much more important movie because, mm-hmm. you know, it's something that handles these messages in my eyes really, really well. You know, we've seen movies try to deliver these sorts of messages before. You know, that doesn't make this movie unique in itself, but the way they've addressed them, a way they've addressed, you know, the themes of trauma and everything else and abuse, and then these sorts of themes as well, you know, I think really does actually make this movie stand apart from so many others that have came before it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I'm going to open up the floor a little bit. I have a couple, I have one or two other little points that I'd like to make. I'm going to open up the floor a little bit for yourself though, because obviously, you know, we've talked a lot about, you know, points that are on my list, but anything that you want to highlight at this point or, you know, discuss it or talk about it in regards to the movie?
Well, no, I think that, you know, kids, as we said before, like kid actors can be, they can make or break a film if they're, you know, and it's just through their sheer, they don't have the resume to build up. They don't have the experience to have that. So I thought that everyone did what they needed. The only one that I probably might complain about is like the menace, like the badass or whatever his name is, like the one that was playing pinball. He seemed a bit like cartoonish compared to the rest of them. But I really want to give Madeline McGraw like her dues, because I think she's the MVP of the whole film. Not only is she the one that's like, she has the visions, which is cool, because, you know, anything with the supernatural and like being able to like see, I'm really into that. Mm-hmm. But I love how like she's just a cool character. She's very, you know, she goes home, she deals with all this nonsense, but she's like still got like that wit about her. And when she tells the detective, she's like, she calls him a fucking fart knocker. I like lost my mind, because I'm like, that's a Beavis and Butthead like fucking insult that I was like, this is awesome. But like her whole thing, like even when she's like, Jesus, what the fuck? Why did you do this? Like, or like, you know, and her like dealing with her way of dealing with the trauma of what's going on and her own ability to like see certain things. I thought she was excellent. Like Ethan Hawke, yes, he's Ethan Hawke, and he is phenomenal in that role, to the point where I can't picture anyone else playing that character. Mm-hmm. But I think Madeline McGraw like kind of steals the show a little bit, because for such a young character to play on everything, she goes through this wide spectrum of emotions, from, you know, the sadness of the terror of being abused and that pain, to the sadness of losing her brother, to like dealing with seeing these visions, to like, you know, trying to figure out, like also having the wit and strength to like fight the bullies. Like she takes a kick in the mouth, like a champion basically. And I think she just goes through the most throughout the entire film. And I think that Madeline McGraw, the actress, portrays that in such a great way. Like I think the sky's the limit for her as an actress. Like I hope that people are still using her and not just looking at her as a kid actress. I think she has a lot of potential to be something great down the line.
I completely agree with you. You know, you're absolutely right. You know, she really does go through it as a character. I really enjoy the fact that, you know, she does give us, you know, those couple of moments of levity in this movie, which I think, you know, are sorely needed at times. You know, it's something I think, I can't remember where I saw it. Someone was on some social media site, you know, the other day, and someone had sort of highlighted that, you know, even in the darkest times, there's always that one person who will crack a joke, or there's always that one person who'll have really dark humor, and then sometimes that doesn't always get portrayed in movies, you know, for various reasons. And I was really glad that, you know, like you say, we had Gwen being like the sort of really foul-mouthed little kid in the principal's office, and, you know, talking to the police officers, and, you know, I really loved that, and it really did make me laugh when I was watching this movie, which is not something I thought I was gonna be doing. But you're right, you know, as a character, you know, the character really does go through it. That's, I really enjoy in that scene as well, where, you know, she does take that kick in the face, where she's just sort of ends up sitting to the side with one of the other bullies who's also taken, you know, a bit of a kicking as well. And they just sort of agree, right, we're just going to tap out for a little bit, you know, while we watch everyone else. So I really enjoyed that as well. But you're right, you know, there is that, it's such a wide range of things that she has to play as well. You know, going from, you know, being that sort of wisecracking smart arse kid in the principal's office to, you know, being a fighter, to also being abused at home, to then, you know, trying to figure out what's going on with the dreams. And, you know, there is almost that there's almost like a little bit of a sort of Dr. Sleep-esque vibe, I think, around her and her dreams. For me, that I definitely got those sorts of vibes. And then, like you said, dealing with the kidnapping of her brother, you know, there's just so much emotions that she has to go through. Madeline McGraw, I think, is 16 now, I think she is. When I looked it up, she's already got about 30 acting credits under her belt. You know, obviously in a variety of different things, but, you know, she's already building up quite a resume, like as you said, you know, which is unusual for, you know, most child actors. You know, her first acting credit was in 2014. She was in an episode of Bones. So over the sort of decades, she's essentially been working since she was 6 years old. You know, and she's been in some notable other notable things as well. You know, she was in American Sniper. She's done some voice work. She was in Cars 3 and Toy Story 4. She was in Ant-Man and the Wasp. So she's got a number of things. And even since the Black Phone came out, you know, we're only talking, what are we talking, 2 years? Not even 2 years since this movie came out. And she's already done, you know, a number of projects since then. As I said, she's down in pre-production for Black Phone 2 as well. So I'm with you. I hope that this is someone who definitely sort of goes on and continues to have a really successful career, because I think the sky's the limit for her. She really has sort of no ceiling in terms of her performances so far, because, you know, the depth of the performance she gives is difficult for, you know, a 40-year-old, let alone a 16-year-old.
Correct. Yeah, I'm glad. I didn't realize that she was like a young Hope in Ant-Man. Like, I never put that together. And that she apparently does the voice of a young Hope in What If. So that's cool that she's attached to that too. But that's like a main point that I wanted to say. Like, because everyone talks about Ethan Hawke, and like, don't get me wrong, he deserves all the praise in the world, because he is also the three main cast members. Him. What's his face? Mason Thames and her all are incredible in this, which is something I kind of like. When I saw, I remember seeing the trailer for this, and I was like, oh, that looks interesting. But I wasn't like expecting much. And then like, I remember being like, you know, it was high on my list of the year. Like when we did our final, like, you know, top 10 of the year, it was pretty high up on my list. Which was not something I would have predicted in January of that year. Like if someone, so all the performances are great. Like the lead performances are great. Like I said, the only issue I might have is that, and I don't think it's necessarily the actor's fault. I think it was just a poorly written script for him, but that the menace, we'll call him for now. his character seemed a little bit cartoonish compared to everyone else.
Yeah, it was a little paint by numbers for him, wasn't it? He was like, you're going to play this bully and you're just going to be this stereotypical bully. There's not really going to be any more depth to that character. I mean, I don't think it would have made a huge amount of difference to the movie, to be honest. Like, but it would realistically, you know, only take in the addition of maybe one scene just to try and give that character a little bit more depth to their sort of emotions. Because even when, you know, Finn's talking to him on the phone, you know, he's still being that sort of stereotypical bully character, even though he's supposed to be giving him advice. You know, definitely agree with you on that. Again, you know, when we were doing, you know, our end of year awards at the end of last year, at the end of 2022, sorry, you know, Black Phone wasn't something that I particularly, same as you, predicted that would be particularly high on people's list. I thought it was maybe going to be one of those sort of movies that just sort of came and went and you know, didn't really upset anything, but I was really pleasantly surprised by it. I kind of felt the same about Knock at the Cabin when that came out earlier in the year. You know, I didn't really expect much from that, and, you know, I actually really enjoyed a lot of the performances in that, maybe for very different reasons, obviously. But I was really pleasantly surprised. You know, Black Phone for us got a lot of recognition from our listeners. It was nominated for pretty much all of the awards that we give out. And like I say, Ethan Hawke won our Best Supporting Performer award for that year. I think the only issue for that year is it came up against X, which, you know, was the fan favorite for 2022. So,
Swept, yeah.
But one
X was kind of a juggernaut.
It wiped the floor in terms of our awards that year. It won like the big three. It is what it is. But I want to talk a little bit about the actual, you know, the movie's called The Black Phone. We haven't really talked much about the actual, you know, phone in the basement, because this is really where the sort of supernatural element and the sort of psychological element of this movie comes alive. You know, is these ghosts communicating through this black phone. And there's obviously varying theories that go on in the movie. There's a scene right at the very beginning after Finn's sort of kidnapped, where the grabber, you know, tells him to hang up the phone. You know, there's another scene where, you know, he's told that the grabber can hear the phone as well. But it's again, something else I think is left a little vague is, you know, sort of, there's obviously this basement, it has this phone in it. We were initially led to believe that the phone doesn't work, it's dysfunctional. But there's obviously, like I say, varying theories about, you know, what the grabber can't do. I don't know, is there a sort of particular train of thought that you subscribe to? Do you think the Grabber does have that sort of supernatural element around him? Is there something sort of otherworldly about the Grabber in your mind? Is it something you take away from that, or is it more just, you know, these are the ghosts of these kids, they're just reaching out, this is their method of reaching out, the Grabber doesn't actually know that?
It's an odd question, because it's like, well, if it doesn't work, why is it there? Like, why didn't you just take it down? Like, yeah. Why does it even exist in that room? But my thought was, what I took it as was, he doesn't necessarily hear it, but I think that, I don't think Finn's the first one to talk to a ghost. I think they have talked to every previous victim. Mm-hmm. And I think that the Grabber knows that something is up with that phone, and he doesn't want Finn to be on it because he doesn't want to get any more. Because my assumption would be like, well, by the time he gets to Miguel, Miguel's probably ahead of the curve on the first victim because he's been getting pieces of information from all the previous victims. But it all doesn't work until they all put all their pieces together, and then it works for Finn. But so my guess is that he doesn't want him on there because he can't prove that anyone's on the phone, but he doesn't. But those kids are talking to someone on the phone, or he thinks they're talking on someone on the phone. The other side of that was, I thought it might have been all in his head. He's not actually talking to the ghost. Like, he knows who they are. Mm-hmm. He knows who all the victims are. And it's just like his own psychological, like running through something. Like, that's how he's coping with it. He is pulling information. But that's probably wrong, though, because how would he have figured out the combination without talking to something?
Yeah, I think
that's the only
thing
that throws me off.
Yeah, I think I sort of go with you along there with the sort of first point that you made there, is that, and it almost lends itself to slightly explain the sort of deterioration of the Grabber's sort of psyche as the movie goes on, because, you know, towards the end there, he's pretty calm and collected at various points of the movie, and, you know, quite intense and intimidating, and I think we do see a little bit of a breakdown of that as the movie goes on. Especially, you know, when it comes to then, you know, Finn trying to do his escape, and, you know, that one scene where Finn does try to escape and eventually gets recaptured, is, you know, the tension in that scene is incredible when, you know, he's trying to get the combination and you know, the Grabber's asleep in his chair, you know, right there next to him. But I think I would go with that in terms of the Grabber knows there's something afoot, doesn't necessarily know what's going on, and that is actually driving him sort of more crazy, because he's trying to figure that out. So I would go with that theory.
Yeah, I only say the psychological stuff is because some people were trying to say that nothing about that film, except for maybe the visions, was the visions were the only things that couldn't be explained. You could explain, oh, someone's going through so much trauma because they're so scared that they start like rationalizing in their own head, like, oh, well, this person would have told me this person would have told me that. But I didn't really subscribe to that. I just saw that theory floating around that it was all in Finn's head. But I was like, but the key that would keep me away from that is specifically for the fact that how else would he have gotten the combination to the lock?
Yeah, I think so.
No, I was just gonna say that's the only thing that like was a definite, like, no, something or someone like had to have told him that.
Yeah, that's the point where you can no longer just go, okay, it's all in his head, because there's a key piece of information. It would have been a different thing if there'd maybe been something else. He'd maybe seen something else in the build up to him going down, and, you know, it could have then been like a core memory that he's managed to, like you say, retrieve through, you know, trauma and whatever else. But we're never shown that, so you know, that theory sort of falls apart a little bit, you know, there. We've kind of gone through the majority of the points that I have to make about this movie. One last thing I've got on this. We've got, there's a bit of a horror trope that police officers are pretty useless. It was kind of nice in this movie to see the police kind of believe Gwen when she's talking about her visions. And in real life as well, you know, that person would just be immediately dismissed as being, you know, sort of batshit crazy. But they kind of went along with her a little bit in this.
Yeah, and I think that, I don't necessarily know she ever, like, really gave them, like, bad advice. But, like, I do agree. Like, I think the idea of them leaning into a medium of sorts is interesting. Because, like, as you said, until the very end of a movie, most of the time they just are like, oh, this girl, this little girl in her imagination, or this old person's, like, you know, if it was someone like our age, they'd be like, ah, they're just crazy. Like, oh, visions. Yeah, okay. Like, you know. But like, I think that them leaning into a medium was a cool concept. Like a little plot device that like added some depth, and it makes the supernatural like stand out a little bit more. It's like, okay, the supernatural actually exists in this universe. Whether you believe in the supernatural in your own real life or whatever, but in this universe, it's like a thing.
Yeah.
So I think that, and the mother had him too. So like, it's a pattern.
Yeah.
I think that, but I thought it was cool that they believed her. It's just a little bit enough to like kind of toy with her, the information she was giving, instead of just blowing her off.
Yeah. And I did also,
and obviously, it proved at the end to be like her visions were for real, because they didn't, obviously it was like, as most mediums in movies, and well, in real life they're usually just completely wrong, but like in movies, she was just a tinge off.
Yeah,
she didn't get him to the right house, she got him to the house where the victims were. She didn't get him to actually where Finn was. I thought that was neat as well, as that, because I didn't see that coming. Like I it's something I feel like I should have seen coming. But because my wife called it like right before it happened, she's like, it's going to be the wrong house. Like, he watch him be like across the street. Like, she knew that like before it happened. I didn't see that coming in the original. Like, I thought that they were going to get there too late. Like, Finn was already going to be like walking up the steps as they like walked in. So I thought that was actually really good that she was just a hair off. Like, yeah, her visions were just off to not be 100% correct, but yeah, I like that.
Yeah, no, that's pretty much what I was about to say there. It's it also kind of just, it gave, despite the fact that she was that little bit off, it almost gave her more credibility in her abilities, yeah, you know? I would like to give myself credit and say that I called it. As they were breaking into the house that Gwen had led them to, I was like, they'll be in the wrong house. But you know, that was a very, very last minute prediction when I'd probably gotten way too much information to really take credit for it. I didn't really see them being across the road. But it, like you say, it all made sense. And yeah, that was definitely something that I really enjoyed, was that she was really unsure about her own abilities. She knew that her mother had abilities, you know, and through the information that we'd been given previously to the film, that's partly what led to her mother, committing suicide, and you know, potentially doing other not great things as well. So there was always that little sort of, there's that sort of hint of danger and risk involved with having this as well. Like you say, she was a little bit off. She led them to the resting places of the other victims, which makes sense. She was seeing the victim. She wasn't seeing her brother. Her brother wasn't dead. You know, so it makes sense that the other victims were taking them to their own sort of bodies and where their remains were. But definitely, you know, I think it'd be quite easy, I think, for a lot of people to just sort of overlook that sort of supernatural element to this movie, because it although it plays a really important role, it does kind of take a back seat a little bit to the sort of just the story between Finn and the Grabber. So I think it's a really important thing to highlight, is that it does actually play a huge role in this movie in saving Finn.
Yeah, I think a lot of the stuff around finding Finn is some of the best parts of the movie. Like, don't get me wrong, I like the interactions between him and the Grabber. I think every scene that they have to share together is great, because it's full of intention. Ethan Hawke playing it up in his like weird, you know, his mask changed throughout the whole film. Sometimes he has two parts, sometimes he just has the bottom, sometimes he just has the top, and it all depends upon how his mood is. Mm-hmm. Like, if he's angry, the mask is angry. If he's like being like that clown like character, the mask is smiling. Like, I thought all that was like really good with them. But I love mysteries, and I think the whole trying to find him was very fascinating to me. Like, that not only I was hooked with the Grabber stuff, but I think what really like made this movie stand out and like be as high received as I did the year when we did our top 10 was because of the mystery element, like the crime solving aspect of it. Mm-hmm. Gave me like a lot of similar vibes to like when you watch like Silence of the Lambs. Obviously Silence of the Lambs doesn't have the supernatural element, but like the whole like finding like the criminal like aspect, like that's what And they went in the wrong house. So there is some similarities to Silence of the Lambs.
I mean, if we want to go quickly down that route, there's a lot of callbacks to various other references and Easter eggs to various other movies in here.
Yeah.
Quite a lot of Stephen King references, which you would absolutely expect, given that it's his son that wrote the story. You know, so that there's an absolute ton of that. I'm done with all my points, but I will open the floor up again for you if there's anything else you want to discuss before we move on.
No, I think you guided me down a pretty good path. I think that's about all I got for you.
Okay. We'll move on to our next segment of the show then, and we'll talk about some trivia.
I'm sure if we bashed your head in, all sorts of secrets would come tumbling out.
As always, we'll start off with the finances of the movie. According to IMDb, this movie had a budget of $18 million and grossed worldwide $161 million. So a pretty decent return. Definitely explains why we've got a sequel in pre-production at the moment. You know, this movie was originally going to be a January release for the theatres, which obviously, as you know, is pretty widely considered to be the dead spot for most horror films that are coming out through the year. But it did so well during its sort of previews and pre-screens with audiences that the Blumhouse pushed it back to a June release, a main release, sorry, because obviously I'm saying this movie came out in 2021. Its main release came out in 2022, but it had obviously been pre-screened.
Yeah, because I feel like I saw the trailer like way before the movie ever came out, so that makes sense.
Yeah, the movie was ready to go essentially at the end of 2021, but then they pushed it back, you know, 5 months essentially. So we knew about this movie. We knew this movie was ready, but then we had to wait 5 more months for it. But I'm glad they did, because I think also that might have just built up a little bit more sort of hope about it as well. You talked about the mask there at the end. You know, it obviously has various parts, various emotions. The mask itself was designed by Tom Savini. So, you know, the greatest there is in terms of effects and props. Mason Thames actually said in an interview that when he saw the mask for the first time, the first scene he filmed with Ethan Hawke in his performance, he was genuinely scared because, you know, he's a young child at this point. And I can imagine for a young child seeing that mask. The first, I'm not sure which the first scene it was they actually filmed, but the first scene we get as well with Ethan Hawke wearing that mask is there is no expression on it as well, which I found quite interesting, because on all the sort of previews we see this mask with this sort of big smile or this big sort of frown that we were talking about, but in that very first scene there is no expression on the mask, and I thought that was quite interesting as well.
Which I think is smart, because I think it's smart to do no expression, because now you don't know how to read them.
Yeah.
And then like, as he goes along with like the way the mask design was incredible, because it's because of the moving parts and it played on emotions, like how the grabber was feeling at the time. So like, of course, Tom Savini is like, you know, the greatest of all time with effects. So that's why that mask is as effective as it is. So.
Yeah, no, 100%. Completely agree with you. The paperboy sort of scene, his kidnapping scene, is a reference to a real child kidnapping as well. There was a child called Johnny Gosh who had been, I think it was Iowa, I think I read that this took place in. He was doing a paper route with his dog, and then he was captured and his dog was found, but he was never found, and that's what they used as reference for that scene in this movie as well, which is you know, unfortunate. It's not great, but. You know, they're obviously, you know, taking from real life stuff as well. As I said earlier in the episode as well, in the short story, the grabber is a clown. But it was Joe Hill himself that suggested that they should change that to a magician for the movie. Apparently, in early drafts of the script as well, the mask was actually leather rather than this sort of. I think it's wooden, right? This mask that he wears. It's some sort of a wood material, but it was originally going to be like a leather sort of thing as well. But Scott Derrickson knew that was what he was going to center the whole marketing campaign around, was Ethan Hawke's face in this mask. So he spent a lot of time redesigning that as well. In terms of trivia. There isn't a huge amount of like interesting trivia around this movie. You'll know yourself when you're researching films. You'll read a lot of trivia. Not all of it is particularly interesting for people to read. So I'm going to cut it there unless you have anything else that you want to bring up that you're aware of around this movie.
No, I mean the only thing I like, the only small piece of information I actually had was that the mask was a Savini mask. And that was it. Yeah, that's the only thing.
That's absolutely fine. Okay, with that being said, then we will quickly move on to our final segment of the show, which is the ratings and the reviews.
A census taker once tried to test me. I ate his liver with some fava beans and a nice Chianti.
And as always, we will start off with the critics' scores. So IMDb has this movie rated at a 6.9 out of 10. Metacritic has it at 6.5. The Rotten Tomatoes critics has it at 82% fresh. The Rotten Tomatoes audience has it at 88% fresh. So really high scores there from some of those critics. The critics' consensus is The Black Phone might have been even more frightening, but it remains entertaining, well-acted adaptation of scarily good source material. The audience opinion on Rotten Tomatoes says, with a terrific villain and a twisty story stacked with edge-of-your-seat thrills, The Black Phone is a must-watch for fans of suspenseful horror. Obviously, as always, with all of our movies, we throw it out to our listeners and followers. I'll ask for your guys' scores and opinions. Just before I get into them, Nico has... He's not here today. He's under the weather. He has sent me his score. So Nico has scored this movie a 9 out of 10. He says, great idea, epic villain, movie seems dirty and gritty, and I love it. So Nico, that's Nico's sort of very, very brief thoughts on it. Anna, who has also been, you know, a guest on quite a few episodes as well now, has also sent us in her score for this. So she scored this an 8 out of 10. She said it was very intense and well-paced. Cast was great. The best boy was gorgeous too. And I double-checked with her. The best boy was the dog. That's what she was talking about. So the best boy was gorgeous too. As I was watching it, I felt as though I went through every emotion. Would definitely come back to it and recommend it to others. So that's Anna and Nico's scores. A few scores from the rest of our listeners and followers. So Kate Lamp also gives it a 9. I thought all of the performances were great. And the way that our imagination was left to fill in the pieces about what was happening to the kids made it feel very sinister. Some people said it wasn't scary, but for me, everything was clenched the entire time and I was exhausted by the end of it. The Dissect That Film podcast gives it a 9. Great performances built on the intense suspense of it all kept me on my edge of my seat the whole way through. Tamagoste on Twitter, Twitter doesn't exist anymore, Tamagoste on X gives it a 5 out of 10. Enjoyed the concept, but the execution just felt a little too flat for me. I wish it had been a little more gritty and a little less polished. Okay. Don't necessarily agree with that, but that's absolutely fine. Neurospice gives it an 8. Joe Hill, whose book this is based on, is a gifted storyteller. I find his tales unique. I don't feel like I've heard them before in other books and movies. Acting is brilliant. Edge of your seat stuff with the phone calls from other victims giving a wonderfully ominous tone. Dashes from Dot gives it a 10. Loved it. Kids were great. The setting was realistic. The mask changing depending on mood and task was scary. The moment he is sleeping in the chair was terrifying. And finally, Cartoon Tomb gives it a 9 out of 10, mostly due to the brilliant acting of the main child actors. Absolutely loved the movie. So all of our audience scores are combined. You guys gave The Black Phone an average score of 8.1 out of 10. So a really high score there from our audience as well. And so that just leaves the two of us. So Ran, on a scale of 0 to 10, what would you rate The Black Phone and why?
I'm going to give it an 8 out of 10. So I line kind of pretty much up with the audience score. I think it's a very fun popcorn flick. Like, I think that this is a good one of those like horror date movies. It's not overly gory. It's not overly scary. It's scary. It's tense. That's probably the better term. It's tense instead of scary. I think that the setting, and I love set piece, like when they're time pieces, I love that it's in the 70s. I think it's gritty enough. It's a Blumhouse film, so it's not going to look like a grindhouse film. They're not going to like rub dirt on the, but I think that the film is, it exceeded expectations. I think that the kid actors are incredible. Probably some of the stronger actors in the whole film. Ethan Hawke has solidified himself with The Grabber as an all-time great. I think that this is something that is when we go 10 years from now and we're like talking about like great films of the past, like, or great villains of the past, I think that the Grabber is now going to be in that conversation. I hope we get a little bit more of him in Black Phone 2, even if he's not like the whole film is not about him, but I hope that we get to see him, more of him, just to more put him on the brains of, you know, people when we're talking about great villains. From everything from the mask to the acting, the execution, the way the story is, it's a half supernatural, half crime solving ghost story. I give it a lot of praise. There's a few here and there. There's like, you know, like I said, about the bully being kind of cartoonish, the detectives kind of essentially being useless, maybe adds, takes a couple points away. But no, I really, really like this film. I'm going to watch it, you know, a bunch more. It'll be one of those films I watch at least once a year, or twice a year, maybe. And I'm glad that, you know, it came out when it did and it didn't get swept under the rug in a January release.
Yeah. I'm pretty much on board with everything you've said there. I think this is one of the rare occasions where everyone involved in this podcast is pretty much in agreement. You know, you've just given it an 8 there, Anna gave it an 8, Nico's given it a 9. I'm going to just split yous all down the middle and give it an 8.5 just to be slightly different. But all the reasons are pretty much exactly the same. Ethan Hawke's performance in this was really incredible. Mason Thames did a really great job as well. And as we were talking about earlier, I think Madeleine McGraw is probably the underrated star of the show as well, given her performance. I'm with you as well. I really love that this is set in the 70s. I think sometimes movies are way too heavily relying on the nostalgia from the 1980s. So it was really nice to get something that just sort of predated that a little bit. I love the fact that this isn't, you know, a gore fest. You know, like, don't get me wrong, and you know, we discussed it on that Terrifier episode. I love a gore fest, yeah. But I love that this isn't that. I love this is, you know, like you said, it's real tense. It's a thriller. It's a mystery. It is scary, I think, for some people, but I think as well, again, you know, without wanting to diminish this movie and what it actually means, because I think this is a really, you know, it's a really in-depth, it tackles some really important issues, but I also do think this could be used as a good sort of intro to horror for people who maybe don't like, you know, a lot of gore and want something that's really tense and you know, a bit of a mystery. So I think it has value there as well. It's definitely a movie that I'll also be revisiting over the course of the next number of years. So it's probably going to be one I'll watch every October at the very least, when spooky season comes around. Definitely one it's very high on the list for me. A real pleasant surprise as well. You know, I'd heard really great things, which did increase my expectations going into it ever so slightly. But when it was first released, I really didn't expect much out of this. And you know, those performances from those three in particular really blew out the water, and the points coming off for me are very similar to the ones, you know, that you gave as well. So I think we're pretty much in agreement with this one, which makes a change from last time. So all of our scores, all of our scores combined with the critic scores and you guys, our listener scores, gives the Black Phone an average score of 8 out of 10. So it's almost as if, you know, that's exactly where this movie should be. It puts it in 19th place on our leaderboard of now 94 movies that we've covered on the show. It is one place above American Psycho and one place below Prey.
So that's an interesting spot.
It's an interesting spot. A couple of the other movies that are just sort of in and around there. It's a couple of places above Candyman and They Live. It's a couple of places below things like The Descent and Hereditary. I think as of right now, obviously we've only covered 94 movies, but it's a top 20 movie for us right now. And I think that's a pretty cool place for it to be.
Yeah. Yeah. Like you said, like, you know, seeing that it's at 19 keeps the theme of pleasantly surprising me.
Yeah,
I did not expect it to land that high, or land in the company of those films, I should say.
It is interesting to know that it is 6 places higher than X, which brings me a little bit of joy.
Well, I think that, yeah, I think with that movie though, and again, not to like stay on it too much, is that there was people that loved it. Like I loved it. It was my favorite film of the year. And then there was people that were definitely that fall in your camp. I didn't feel like there was a lot of people that were really like in between. Like, I don't feel like, it was fine. Like, I think there was a lot of people that, yeah, that didn't live up to the expectations, but yeah. No. I'm interested to hear your thoughts on Pearl because it's a much different viewing experience.
Yeah, I've heard that a lot. So I really, really need to get around to it. I should probably just chuck it on the schedule for some point in the next few months, and that'll guarantee that I finally get around to it. So we'll probably do that. We'll maybe do me and Nico might do a double header when Maxine comes out. But yeah, that is that's going to do it for us this week on the show. Thank you for, very, very much, Ren, for joining me once again. It was a pleasure to have you back on the show. Obviously, you know, welcome back anytime. We still have a bucket list of horror episode, like I say, on the back burner, but I do plan on getting around to them again at some point as well. But I wanted to get you back on the show sooner rather than later anyway. So thank you again for coming on and having a nice discussion with me about this movie.
Yeah, it was, I love coming on the show. You know, I've been a big fan of, and now friend for a while. So yeah, it's always a pleasure to get to talk to you guys. Awesome. I mean, Nico's a punk for not being here today, but you know, we'll
deal with it. He's so unreliable. No, we send best wishes to Nico. Nico is very, I spoke to him earlier and he does not have the voice for recording today. I'll just say that. But we send him our best wishes. Hopefully he gets well soon. But yeah, thank you once again. Do you want to just remind everyone about Horrorflix Guitar Picks once again and where you can be found and they can be found?
Sure thing. Me, the terror of the internet, you can find me on all of the social medias as RenXXX. You can find me once a month on the Horrorflix and Guitar Picks podcast, which is Horrorflix and Guitar Picks Pod on Twitter, and as Horrorflix and Guitar Picks podcast on Instagram and Facebook. Like I said, I'm not the star of that show. That's Tim's baby. He interviews musicians and people from the film industry about their relationships with horror. I highly suggest that. There's some very, very good interviews throughout his, like, I think he's on like episode like 300. He's like way up there in numbers.
He's definitely been churning out that content. But no, I completely agree. I highly recommend going and checking out Horrorflix and Guitar Picks. So it's a podcast that has been around my regular rotation for quite a while now. So definitely go check that out. Obviously, you know, Ren, you've now been on a couple of episodes. Tim's, you know, really great and, you know, really great people and really, really interesting interviews and reviews going on there. So definitely, definitely go check that out. And once again, for anyone who wants to support this show across our social medias, you can find us on X at Damned Podcast. We're on Facebook and Instagram at Pod of the Damned. You can email us at podofthedamned@gmail.com and you can subscribe to us on Patreon, patreon.com/podonthedamned. Up next on the show, we have another special guest joining us. It's Newman from the Movies for Days podcast. Will be joining us and we are talking about Mandy, which is a movie that definitely leaves some people with some food for thought. So I'll be very interested to see what Newman's got to say about that. And then when Nico returns from his illness, we will be talking all about Army of the Dead, which was supposed to be the next episode we released, but obviously he's been unwell, so we've not been able to record it, but we'll be talking Army of the Dead. And then hopefully Anna will be back on the podcast at some point in the next few weeks as well. So until next week on the Pod of the Damned, thank you once again to everyone for downloading and listening to this episode. Once again to Ren for joining us. And as I say, until next week on the Pod of the Damned, just remember, you're damned if you do, and you're damned if you don't.